Hi, everyone, and welcome to Documentation Station. I'm Steve Welton. Thank you for joining me. If you stumbled upon this podcast from one of the various platforms that broadcasts podcasts, I am a documentation consultant, and I work with behavioral health clinicians across the United States, primarily on strengthening clinical documentation standards in their practice. My consulting business is accessed through WeltonConsulting.com. I started Documentation Station as a place to discuss a variety of topics related to clinical documentation and other topics related to practice with behavioral health professionals. Today, I want to start the conversation about creating safety and managing risk within the context of psychotherapy. While this topic will go into components around how to document information in the treatment record, most of my focus will be on the process itself. I think we can all agree that the psychotherapeutic relationship begins with safety and trust. And, you know, we begin the therapeutic process by asking a bunch of questions. In the modern version of this, many, if not most of us, sent out a questionnaire prior to the first appointment to gather historical information. And I support that. I think it's a great process, and I encourage it with all of my consulting clients. It's a great way to capture historical information from your new client. But that doesn't change the fact that unless this is a returning client, they don't know you. And you don't know them. So the level of trust in that therapeutic relationship is comparatively low. Compound that with the reality that they are coming to you out of a woundedness simply complicates things as it relates to trust and safety. And yet, trust and safety is the very nature of our work. Establishing a safe place for your client so that the two of you can enter into the work of therapy. To add to that complexity of this, in the world where many episodes of therapy occur over telehealth these days, there is an immediate, additional, actual physical distance that exists that we must now cross in order to be able to be effective in treating with the client. However the therapy will be delivered, developing a safe space is of chief concern. It's complicated, challenging, but entirely necessary. Some may argue, and I think I would agree, that this creation of safe space really can begin before the first therapy session really gets very started with the discussion of informed consent. I know, a lot of you may be thinking, what? I'm not even entirely sure what informed consent is. Others may just think, oh, it's that paperwork obligation I need to have the client sign. I Googled and downloaded that, so I'm all good. But the informed consent is not just some form you have to have your client read and sign to keep you out of trouble from a possible ethics complaint with your licensing board. Though, of course, you definitely want to have a signed informed consent form in case that complaint ever arises. You want to make sure that's in the file. But what I'm talking about today is more about what the informed consent really is all about. Now, for those of you who have not really read that form that your attorney or some attorney wrote, the informed consent is an expectation that we will explain to the client what they can anticipate through psychotherapy and do it in sufficient detail so that they can make an informed decision and give consent about their participation in the process. Through the informed consent, you are initiating the therapeutic relationship by empowering the client to make decisions about their own agency in the process. Dr. Behrs and Guthiel wrote about the benefits of informed consent in their article on the topic. In their minds, informed consent has the capacity to empower patients' self-therapeutic activity and protecting them against cult-like information-controlled elements that are sometimes present in psychotherapy. Wow, I know, that's strong language, but what they are saying is that the informed consent encourages, right out of the blocks, that the client becomes not just a passive audience for the magic the therapist brings to the process, but as a more active agent on their own behalf through the psychotherapeutic process. In their argument, they remind us that it is what the clients do for themselves that correlates with the therapeutic change far more than what the therapists say or do. The process of psychotherapy, at its best, is when the therapist utilizes all of their interpersonal and therapeutic skills in their arsenal to influence the client towards improved self-help and self-agency. Informed consent, done well, has the power to lessen dependency, a risk we all know can be present in psychotherapy, which can lead to ineffective therapy. Instead, informed consent helps to build the therapeutic partnership and allows the client a level of self-advocacy in the process. It empowers the client at the outset, which helps to establish a level of safety and trust. Psychotherapy is not something that happens to the client. It happens with the client in a partnership. The challenge of the informed consent, of course, is the conversation about the potential for negative outcomes for treatment. We cannot know what the path of discovery might bring. We cannot know how the client's friends and family might respond to their healthier version of themselves. And all of those people can have an impact on the course of treatment outside of the therapy room. Informed consent represents the therapeutic partnership in treatment. It reminds the client that their improvement will be at least partly, maybe even mostly, through their own efforts and their trust in the process. Now, that includes a level of honesty and introspection in the therapeutic process. So, as we step into the therapeutic process, we operate in waters that are not always clear. How much does the client really trust that process at this point? For most, probably not much. This, of course, makes the process of completing assessments and establishing a context for discussing risk with the client consistently challenging, which is why it is so important to make it normal to evaluate safety always. We have this emerging therapeutic bond where we are establishing trust and safety. We need to be comfortable checking in with them on how they are doing and if they are feeling safe. I know most of us do this. I know many of us even feel really comfortable doing it. But I also know that this is not universal. There are clinicians who are uncomfortable asking whether their client is safe or not. If we did the informed consent thing right, we should have mentioned to them right from the get-go that we're going to be checking in on them when they come in for therapy. We want them to know that this is a place where they can be honest, express their deepest angst, and if they are struggling one week, they should know we're going to ask them how they're doing and whether they feel safe, and they'll be able to say, even if it's out of the blue, when they are not. I've had conversations with clinicians who have told me, if they tell me they are not suicidal during the assessment, I don't ask the question again until they tell me that something has changed. But if you have not made it a safe enough place just to talk about it, how do they know when it's okay? I remember my first Sentinel event audit when I was an auditor. It was in 2007, and I remember it like it was yesterday. So what's a Sentinel event audit, you might ask? For the company I worked for, at least, it was a quality of care site audit requested by a national standing committee of psychiatrists, primarily, that review and investigate when something bad happens to a member who was in active treatment or at least recently in treatment. While that can encompass a wide variety of things, in this case, the bad thing I'm talking about was a completed suicide. So I was clinically auditing this psychotherapist, treating the member to try and understand what happened. So it was a combination of an interview and a treatment record review. The client was your typical adjustment disorder with a depressed mood type of client. He had been in treatment for a few years. The client had confidently said in the initial assessment that he was not suicidal, and the therapist believed him. And it probably was even true at that time. There was a treatment plan. The progress notes were fine, except the therapist never again completed a risk assessment, even after a significant loss had occurred in the client's life and the deeper depressive symptoms that brought him into treatment in the first place returned. They returned back into the same work that they had done before that was in the treatment plan, and the client seemed, at some level, to be doing a little bit better. But apparently he wasn't. Now, when I met with a clinician in his office, he was still pretty crestfallen about what had occurred. And this was a few months after the event. I reviewed a few of the records, including that of the member in question, and none of them had risk assessments. When I spoke to the clinician, I asked him, he told me, well, I don't really treat that sort of a client. Everything else in his records show he was a good therapist. He had good treatment plans. His progress notes were overall pretty complete. And really, as I was reading the progress notes, I could tell that the client was struggling a little bit. He did a good job of actually capturing that. I ultimately felt terrible for the clinician. He thought his practice was okay and safe because he didn't treat that sort of a client. In a country where, according to the National Alliance on Mental Illness, about 5% of adults in the U.S. have suicidal thoughts every year, 11% of young adults do, and a whopping 18% of adolescents do, many of us clinicians are bound to have a client at some point in time who's experiencing suicidal thoughts. Some of them will even tell us. And especially if we make the therapy room a safe place to talk about it. When they do tell us, we have to be okay and we have to be ready to take the next steps, assess them with where they are. The Columbia Suicide Severity Risk Scale, or the CSSRS, or the Ask Suicide Questions, or the ASQ, are both good, quick, effective screening tools. If there is some suicidal risk there and they can believably contract for safety, work with them to develop a safety plan. If they cannot contract for safety, or you have doubts about what they're telling you related to contracting for safety, help them. Help them get to where they need to be, somewhere safe. Get them to the local emergency department where they can be thoroughly assessed, and then use emergency services to do it. Why do I say it that way? Well, yeah, while a well-meaning parent, partner, or friend might be more than willing to offer to take them to the hospital themselves, there are way too many incidences every year where those passengers will talk the driver out of taking them to the hospital and instead have them take them home where they are unsafe. Or, in a worse situation, the individual ends up jumping out of the car to escape. The driver in a private car is not equipped to support a person who is in crisis. So don't place them in that predicament. All of this, of course, gets oh so much more complex if you're seeing that client through telehealth. Now, most states and certainly most insurance companies want you to confirm now where the client is when you're treating them every single session. Now, there are any number of reasons for this. Some of them have to do with where you are able to practice due to your licensing rules, but some of it is around safety. There is nothing quite so helpless a feeling as dealing with a suicidal individual when you're not quite sure where they are. If you've ever worked on a suicide helpline or as a clinician on a health insurance intake line, for that matter, you know what I mean. Creating a safe treatment environment is a weighty task for us in the behavioral health community. It is our first task with the client, and all the best work happens after we establish it. When the client feels safe and they know they have agency in their own therapy process, and that the two of you are working together, and they are empowering themselves to live as healthy a life as possible, the interaction can be quite powerful and transformative. It ultimately allows a level of honesty that can quite literally save their life, even in the darkest moments when they might otherwise be feeling completely alone and powerless. And as the two of you progress through the treatment plan, it helps the client to remain the primary agent of their improvement with your guidance and support. This is Documentation Station.